Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 1182. Terror, the Afghanistan War, and the American Deep State, Part 2. This is being recorded on April 20th of the year 2021. Before we get into the main body of the program itself, let me remind you of two things. First of all, sister station WFMU is podcasting the For the Record programs, and you can go to a link at the top of any post or any program description on the SpitfireList.com website, and there is a link for you to subscribe to the For the Record programs via podcast, if that is the way, the best way for you to consume the program. Again, WFMU, podcasting the For the Record programs, a link at the top of every post and program description for you to subscribe. I am extremely pessimistic about the future, in case you couldn't tell, and I would like to be optimistic and say, yep, it's going to be okay if we all work hard enough. And then, you know, it just, I don't believe it. I think we are in the twilight of our civilization. And I think that the future bodes very poorly. And I think what lies in the future is a nightmare of suffering and death and ruin, and I wish I didn't feel that way, but I would bet on that. I think it is absolutely imperative that every one of us do as much as we can to ideally communicate this information to others, or at the very least, to preserve the information that I have worked so hard to elevate. And all of my material is from open sources. It does not originate with me. However, I refer to myself as a journalistic step-up transformer. I take material on the public record and try to make it more visible so that more people will become aware of it. In that regard, everything that I have done in my career, and I'm now in my 42nd year on the air, is available on a 32-gigabyte flash drive, along with a mini library of old anti-fascist books that are absolutely fundamental to an understanding of what is going on. I get no money from that flash drive whatsoever, and again, it is available. It goes through For the Record 1156. I get no money whatsoever from that flash drive. And again, it has my entire life's work on it, for free. And, for free to me, I get nothing from it. For a very modest contribution, tax deductible, you can get that. Again, there is a link at the top of every post and at the top of every program description for you to click on to get that flash drive. And at the very least, you yourselves can become a repository for this information and can pass on the devastating story of what happened to this world to succeeding generations, assuming for the sake of argument there are succeeding generations. In this program, we are going to continue with discussion about the circumstances leading up to our involvement in Afghanistan. Joe Biden announced last week that he was going to pull the last of the U.S. combat troops from Afghanistan by September 11th of this year. That is the anniversary of course, the September 11th attacks. And that terrorist attack was the latest and biggest in a series of overlapping terrorist attacks that were covered up to one extent or another, for reasons I'm about to explain. And the cover-up of those attacks and the participants in them and the programs in which they were participating, proxy wars as part of covert operations in Afghanistan against the Soviets, in the former Yugoslavia, and in parts of the former Soviet Union, and also involving drug trafficking to finance some of those covert operations. For those overlapping reasons, a number of overlapping terrorist incidents, the assassination of extremist Rabbi Meir Kahane, the 1993 bomb attack on the World Trade Center, the Landmarks case in which the same milieu involved with the attack on the World Trade Center were conspiring to blow up a series of landmarks, including the Statue of Liberty, the George Washington Bridge, and the Lincoln and Holland tunnels in New York City. The aborted Bozhinka plot, Bozhinka is Big Bang in Croatian, that was a plan to blow up a series of airliners more or less simultaneously over the Pacific, and the milieu that was involved with plotting that also heavily overlapped not only the milieu of the 1996 World Trade Center bombing, but as we shall see, it also involved people such as Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who were involved in the September 11th attacks as well. In addition, a major figure in the concatenation that we have been speaking about and that we are going to begin speaking about again in a minute, a fellow named Ali Mohammed, overlaps almost, or it was involved in the milieu, plural, of all of these attacks. A quick correction before we go back to our discussion. I misspoke when I characterized the Al-Kifa refugee center in Brooklyn as a mosque. It is not. It is a refugee center and was a major epicenter of jihadist activity in the overlapping series of both terrorist incidents and covert operations that I just set forth. The blind Sheikh Abdul Rahman was involved with the Al-Kifa Center and also had his own mosque in New Jersey, but Al-Kifa was not a mosque. Now we are going to once again return to a very important book. It is titled The American Deep State, subtitled Wall Street, Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy. It was authored by the brilliant Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott, a name well known to veteran listeners to these broadcasts. We've used his material for many years. I guess I think the first material I used by Professor Scott was an essay called The Kennedy Assassination and the Vietnam War in the volume that he tri-edited called The Assassinations, Dallas and Beyond. That essay, The Kennedy Assassination and the Vietnam War, was taken from Peter's suppressed book, The War Conspiracy, and I first recorded that in the spring of 1981, almost exactly 40 years ago. It is in both The Guns of November, Part 3, and also in a miscellaneous, or in a For the Record program as well. Peter Dale Scott, now in his early 90s, is one of the most important and most brilliant and most venerable of the researchers whose work that I have accessed. The book is published in hardcover by Bowman and Littlefield. Actually, it is Roman, R-O-M-A-N, and Littlefield. Copyright, that's a hardcover edition, copyright 2015 by Peter Dale Scott. Now, in discussing the overlapping terror incidents and the cast of characters in them, again, the assassination of extremist Rabbi Meir Kahane, which was laid at the door of a lone deranged gunman, Mr. Nosair, although there were many others involved, this left some of the participants free to engage in the World Trade Center bombing in February of 1993. That milieu in turn overlaps the aforementioned Operation Bozhinka or Operation Big Bang, and that in turn overlaps the Landmarks case, and it also overlaps the September 11th attacks as well. And Ali Muhammad figures centrally in that milieu and in the 1998 embassy bombing in Nairobi, Kenya. We are going to pick up where we left off in our last program, and talking about the unwillingness of both the FBI and elements of the New York Police Department to expand the investigation into Kahane's assassination any further than just the lone deranged gunman or jihadist, take your pick, Mr. Nosair, N-O-S-A-I-R. We read, blaming the New York County District Attorney, blaming the New York County District Attorney, Robert Morgenthau, the FBI later claimed that the evidence retrieved from Nosair's home was not processed for 2 or 3 years. But Robert Friedman suggests that the FBI were not just lying to the public, but also to Morgenthau, who had just helped expose and bring down the CIA-favored Muslim bank, BCCI, a Saudi-sponsored ally of the Safari Club. By the way, the Safari Club, a consortium of intelligence services put together by not only the Saudis, but with French intelligence and elements of CIA as well, to specifically circumvent the modest restrictions on the operations of the intelligence community that came out of the overlapping congressional investigations in the U.S. in the mid-1970s. The BCCI heavily linked to the CIA terrorism, drug trafficking, the Iran-Contra scandal, and one of the elements figuring very large in the background of George W. Bush as well, as we have looked at in For the Record 310 and then again in 356. George W. Bush had his first oil company, Arbusto Energy, financed in part by the family of Osama bin Laden. His brother Salim bin Laden helped put up some of the money through conduits set up by James R. Bath of the CIA, and the BCCI milieu is fundamental to an understanding of the background of George W. Bush. It was Gait Faron of the BCCI whose protege, Talat Otman, was not only gave a Muslim benediction at the Republican convention in 2000. He was a director of Harkin Energy, and it was Talat Otman, along with other prominent Muslims who interceded, U.S. Muslims who interceded with then Treasury Secretary Paul O'Neill on behalf of the milieu that was busted on March 20th, 2002 in the Operation Green Quest raids. The central element in that series of raids, which ultimately the conspiracy therein was covered up by then FBI Director Robert Mueller. The central element in that was the International Institute of Islamic Thought, and that is an element that looms very large in the ongoing covert operation in Xinjiang province in China, where some of these same jihadist elements, in particular Uyghurs, a Muslim Turkophone minority in Xinjiang province, are being used once again as proxy warriors, this time against China. And the IIIP figures in that background as we looked, it figures in that milieu as we looked at in For the Record programs 1178, 1179, and 1180. Once again, going back to Peter Dale Scott's The American Beefsteak, according to other sources familiar with the case, the FBI told District Attorney Robert M. Morgenthau that Nosair, the assassin of Meir Kahane, was a lone gunman. He was not, and not part of a broader conspiracy. He was. The prosecution took this position at trial and lost, only convicting Nosair of gun charges. Morgenthau speculated the CIA may have encouraged the FBI not to pursue any other leads, these sources say. Quote, the FBI lied to me, unquote, Morgenthau told colleagues. Quote, they are supposed to untangle terrorist connections, but they can't be trusted to do the job, unquote. Using evidence from the Nocere trial transcript, Peter Lance confirms the tension between Morgenthau's office, which wanted to pursue Nocere's international terrorist connections, and the FBI, which insisted on trying Nocere alone. The next section of Peter Dale Scott's book is called The FBI's Protection of Ali Mohammed in the 1993 World Trade Center Bombing. Ali Mohammed, linked to or involved with the U.S. Special Forces milieu, was in one of the central people involved in the 1998 bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi, Kenya, and he is part and parcel to the Al-Kifa refugee center milieu that runs through the assassination of Kahane, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, the Landmarks case, Operation Bojinka, and last, but most assuredly not least, the 9/11 attacks that led to our involvement in Afghan, or in the latest of the Afghan wars. The first one, of course, being the covert operation against the former Soviet Union. That was one of the ongoing covert operations that Ali Mohammed and the milieu that we're talking about here was involved with. Peter Dale Scott's section here, again, the FBI's protection of Ali Mohammed in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. In thus limiting the case, the police and the FBI were in effect protecting not just Ali Mohammed, but also Nocere's two Arab co-conspirators, Mahmoud Aboulima and Mohammed Salome, in the murder of a U.S. citizen. The two were thus left free to kill again on February 26, 1993, 1 month after the FBI secured Mohammed's release in Vancouver. Both Aboulima and Salome were ultimately convicted in connection with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, along with another Mohammed trainee, Nidal Ayad, A-Y-Y-A-D. To quote a Pentagon biography yet again, in February 1993, the terrorist cell that Mohammed had trained exploded a truck bomb under the World Trade Center that killed 6 and injured about 1,000 persons. The perpetrators of this bombing included people Mohammed had trained, and Mohammed had been in close contact with the cell during the period leading up to the bombing, i.e. January of 1993, the month of Mohammed's detention and release in Vancouver. Mohammed's name appeared on a list of 118 potential unindicted co-conspirators that was prepared by federal prosecutors. Ali Mohammed was again listed as one of 172 unindicted co-conspirators in the follow-up Landmarks case, which convicted Sheikh Rahman and others of blowing up, of plotting to blow up the United Nations, the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, and the George Washington Bridge, parenthetically not the Statue of Liberty. I was misremembering. Continuing. Actually, let me reread that last sentence. Ali Mohammed was again listed as one of 172 unindicted co-conspirators in the follow-up Landmarks case, which convicted Sheikh Rahman and others of plotting to blow up the UN, the Lincoln and Holland tunnels, and the George Washington Bridge. The two cases were closely related, as much of the evidence from the Landmarks case came from an informant, Imad Salem, whom the FBI had first planted among the World Trade Center plotters. But the prosecutor's awareness of Ali Mohammed's involvement must be contrasted with the reported intelligence failure at the CIA's Counterterrorism Center, or CTC. According to Steve Cole, COLL, the CTC, quote, immediately established a 7-day, 24-hour task force to collect intelligence about the World Trade Center bombing, but nothing of substance came in. In the World Trade Center bombing case, the FBI moved swiftly to bring the Al-Qaeda plotters to trial 1 month later, in March. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, S-H-A-F-F-E-R, a Defense Intelligence Agency officer, later said, we, i.e. BIA, were surprised at how quickly they, the FBI, had made arrests after the first World Trade Center bombing. Only later did we find out that the FBI had been watching some of these people for months prior to both incidents, i.e. both the 1993 World Trade Center bombing and September 11th. Schaefer's claim that the FBI had been watching some of the plotters is abundantly corroborated, for example, by Steve Cole in the book Ghost Wars. And the next section of Peter Dale Scott's book talks about protection for the Maktab network. That was the Maktab al-Qidamat that was running the Mujahideen covert operation in Afghanistan. And then Vice President and former CIA Director George H.W. Bush was in charge of that, as we have seen in a number of our For the Record shows, including some of our visits with the brilliant John Loftus. In Peter Dale Scott's definition of the American deep state, he points out that the deep state involves some fundamental connections to other countries, and it is that broader international milieu that could be seen as one of the fundamental elements of the deep state, and it is also one of the factors in negating justice and American interest in some of these cases. The next section, the U.S., Egyptian, and Saudi backing for the Maktab network. What was being protected here by the FBI? One obvious answer is an extension of Peter Lance's explanation for Zent's behavior. That's an FBI agent who vouched for Ali Mohammed when the RCMP had detained him at Vancouver Airport. One more time. One obvious answer is an extension of Lance's explanation for Zent's behavior, that Mohammed had already been a domestic FBI informant since 1992. However, I entirely agree with New York County District Attorney Robert Morgenthau, who suspected that a much larger asset was being protected. The Saudi-sponsored network that we now know was the Maktab al-Qidamat, by this time already evolving into al-Qaeda. On the day the FBI arrested four Arabs for the World Trade Center bombing, saying it had all of the suspects, Morgenthau's ears pricked up. He did not believe the four were, quote, self-starters, unquote, and speculated that there was probably a larger network as well as a foreign sponsor. He also had a hunch that the suspects would lead back to Sheikh Abdel Rahman. But he worried correctly that the dots might not be connected because the U.S. government was protecting the Sheikh for his help in Afghanistan. This larger network of the Maktab, although created in 1984, consolidated an assistance program that had been launched by the U.S. government much earlier in Egypt by Zbigniew Brzezinski. By the way, he was Jimmy Carter's national security advisor, and his daughter Mika Brzezinski is a major television commentator. Continuing. At almost the beginning of the Afghan war itself, Brzezinski arranged for a program to train members of the anti-communist Muslim Brotherhood, a group that the CIA and the British MI6 had supported in various ways since the 1950s. In January of 1980, Brzezinski visited Egypt to mobilize support for the jihad. Within weeks of his visit, Anwar Sadat authorized Egypt's full participation, giving permission for the U.S. Air Force to use Egypt as a base and recruiting, training, and arming Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood activists for battle. Not only were they packaged and shipped to Afghanistan, but by the end of 1980, they received expert training from U.S. Special Forces. U.S. military trainers had in fact already been in Egypt since at least 1978, the year of the Israel-Egypt Camp David peace accords, training Sadat's elite Praetorian Guard, of which Ali Mohammed was at the time a member. At first, the training was handled by a, quote, private, unquote, firm, J.J. Capucci and Associates, owned by former CIA officers Ed Wilson and Theodore Shackley, who is said to have been collaborating at this time with the Safari Club. But after Brzezinski's visit in 1980, the contract was taken over by the CIA. In 1981, Ali Mohammed was selected out of the U.S.-trained Praetorian Guard for 4 months of Special Forces training at Fort Bragg. Quote, working alongside Green Beret, he learned unconventional warfare, counterinsurgency operations, and how to command elite soldiers on difficult missions, unquote. Mohammed was in Fort Bragg as part of the Pentagon's Professional Military Education Program for Future Leaders. He was being trained to transmit to Egypt the kind of Afghanistan-related skills that he later provided to Al-Khifa on Long Island in 1989. Mohammed was thus in America when some of his fellow Guard members, responding to a fatwa or religious order from Muslim Brotherhood member Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, by the way, of the Al-Khifa Center and the Ali Mohammed Milieu, assassinated Sadat in October of 1981. One more time. Mohammed was thus in America when some of his fellow Guard members, responding to a fatwa or religious order from Muslim Brotherhood member Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, assassinated Sadat in October of 1981. The assassination only accelerated the export out of Egypt to Afghanistan of Muslim Brotherhood members accused of the murder. These included two of Mohammed's eventual close associates, Sheikh Abdel Rahman, and Rahman's then-friend Ayman al-Zawahiri, to whom Mohammed swore a bayat or oath of allegiance in 1984 after his return to Egypt. In other words, Ali Mohammed was a double agent in a milieu much broader than just the San Francisco FBI office, a milieu involving the United States, Egypt, and Al-Qaeda. In the next chapter, we shall suggest that in assisting Osama bin Laden, Mohammed was also serving the interests of Saudi Arabia. And the next chapter in Peter Dale Scott's book, The Falsified War on Terror 2, subtitled How the Deep State Has Protected Gulf Arab States Rather Than the American People. Now, once again, this talks about not just ongoing covert operations, not only the war in the 80s against the Soviet Union in Afghanistan, but as we will see, the subsequent operations in the former Yugoslavia, specifically Bosnia, and later parts of the Soviet Union. And also, we are going to look at one of the factors in these covert operations, which is the sustaining of those covert operations and later Al-Qaeda itself through drug trafficking. In particular, heroin from Uzbekistan. And the next section, a small section of Peter Dale Scott's book, The Al-Qaeda Target in 1993. Not Afghanistan, but Bosnia. Morgenthau's suspicion in 1993 that Al-Qaeda was recruiting Al-Qaedists for Afghanistan were very pertinent. But they were also anachronistic. By 1993, under its new director, James Woolsey, both the CIA and Al-Qaeda had lost interest in Afghanistan. The new interim president of Afghanistan, Mojadebi, capital M-O-G-A-B-B-E-B-I, under pressure from Washington, had announced that the Arab Afghans should leave. In January of 1993, Pakistan followed suit, closed the offices of all Mujahideen in its country, and ordered the deportation of all Arab Afghans. The Al-Qaeda Support Network, in conjunction with wealthy backers in Saudi Arabia, now had new targets in mind elsewhere. After 1991, the Brooklyn Center was focused chiefly on training people for jihad in Bosnia, and at least two sources alleged that Ali Mohammed himself visited Bosnia in 1992, when he also returned to Afghanistan. And reading again from material from the Pentagon Report, Al-Qaeda's English-language newsletter, Al-Hussam, or The Sword, also began publishing regular updates on the jihad action in Bosnia. Under the control of the minions of Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, the newsletter aggressively incited sympathetic Muslims to join the jihad in Bosnia and Afghanistan themselves. The Al-Qaeda Bosnian branch in Zagreb, Croatia, housed in a modern two-story building, was evidently in close communication with the organizational headquarters in New York. The deputy director of the Zagreb office, Hassan Hakim, admitted to receiving all orders and the funding directly from the main United States office of Al-Qaeda on Atlantic Avenue, controlled by Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman. One of Ali Mohammed's trainees at Al-Qaeda, Rodney Hampton L., capital H-A-M-P-T-O-N hyphen capital E-L, assisted in a support program recruiting warriors from U.S. Army bases like Fort Belvoir and also training them in New Jersey to be fighters. In 1995, Hampton L. was tried and convicted for his role, along with Al-Qaeda leader Sheikh Omar Abdelrahman, in the plot to blow up New York landmarks. At the trial, Hampton L. testified how he was personally given thousands of dollars for this project by Saudi Prince Faisal in the Washington Saudi embassy. In addition, quote, Saudi intelligence has contributed to Sheikh Rahman's legal defense fund, according to Mohammed Al-Khilawi, K-H-I-L-E-W-I, the former first secretary to the Saudi mission at the UN. Later in this chapter, we shall have much more to say about Saudi support for this terrorist network, and in particular about the Saudi embassy in Washington. The next section is Al-Qaeda, Al-Qaeda, Tajikistan, and drugs. Meanwhile, the Pakistani Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI, had not lost interest in bin Laden's Arabs, but began to recruit them with bin Laden's support for battle in new areas, notably Central Asia and Kashmir. Bin Laden, in the same period, began to dispatch his al-Qaedists in the areas of the former Soviet Union, notably to the infant Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, or IMU, in Tajikistan. The outbreak of Islamist violence in Tajikistan moved bin Laden to send a limited number of al-Qaeda cadre to support Tajik Islamist forces, among them his close associate Wali Khan Amin Shah, an Uzbek leader later working in the Philippines with Ramzi Youssef and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and the soon-to-be-famous Mujahid Ibn Khattab. By the way, he was very active in Chechnya. In addition, Bin Laden, even after his 1991 move to Sudan, continued to run training camps in Afghanistan, where he welcomed the chance to train Tajiks, Uzbeks, Uyghurs, and Chechens. By the way, note Uyghurs, an extension of this same ongoing, overlapping series of covert operations, which also engendered terrorist operations, is currently underway in Xinjiang province in China. And that is what is behind the one of the major factors underlying the Uyghur genocide myth. Do note the Uyghurs. By the way, we've been talking about the Uyghurs as an Al-Qaeda-affiliated jihadist milieu since, for the record, 348. I did that in 2003 off the top of my head. I don't remember when. But considering that this is, for the record, 1182, 348 is a long time ago. And we were reading at the time from the book Dollars for Terror by Richard Labeviere. But do note the Uyghurs here. Continuing. In an Al-Qaeda document captured in Iraq, Bin Laden wrote, quote, "With the grace of Allah, we were successful in cooperating with our brothers in Tajikistan in various fields, including training. We were able to train a good number of them, arm them, and deliver them to Tajikistan. Moreover, Allah facilitated to us delivering weapons and ammunition to them. We pray that Allah grants us all victory," unquote. Many other accounts report that the delivery of arms and ammunition was facilitated by the involvement of the IMU, that is the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and Bin Laden in the massive flow of heroin from Afghanistan into the former Soviet Union. According to Ahmed Rashid, quote, "Much of the IMU's financing came from the lucrative opium trade through Afghanistan." Rolf Mutschke, M-U-T-S-C-H-K-E, the Assistant Director of Interpol's Criminal Intelligence Directorate, estimated that 60% of Afghan opium exports were moving through Central Asia, and that, quote, "the IMU may be responsible for 70% of the total amount of heroin and opium transiting through the area," unquote. Among the experts confirming the IMU Al-Qaeda drug connection is journalist Gretchen Peters. "The opium trade supported the global ambitions of Osama bin Laden. There was evidence that bin Laden served as middleman between the Taliban and Arab drug smugglers. With Mullah Omar's approval, bin Laden hijacked the state-run Ariana Airlines, turning it into a narco-terror charter service," according to former U.S. and Afghan officials. One U.S. intelligence report seen by the author described a smuggling route snaking up through Afghanistan's northwest provinces in Baghdis, Faryab, and Jozan into Turkmenistan. It was being used as of mid-2004 by, quote, "extremists associated with the Taliban, the Islamic Movement of Uzbekistan, and Al-Qaeda," the report said. Traffickers would move both, quote, "heroin and terrorists," unquote, along the route, and, quote, "then onwards into other countries in Central Asia," unquote, the CIA document said. It has been widely reported that in the early 1990s, as financial support dwindled and bin Laden's finances were being rapidly exhausted in Sudan, his new involvement with the IMU and later the Taliban involved Al-Qaeda also in the growing Afghan heroin traffic. Peters saw a CIA document confirming this. Yet the 9/11 Commission report, in contorted language, denied this, as did a staff report. Quote, no persuasive evidence exists that Al-Qaeda relied on the drug trade as an important source of revenue, had any substantial involvement with conflict diamonds, or was financially sponsored by any foreign government. But those are all absolute bald-faced lies. And I would also note that many other programs involving many other authors, including the tremendous series of programs and interviews we've done with Daniel Hopsicker over the years, the tremendous series of interviews and programs we've done with John Loftus over the years, deal with not only these same phenomena, but with other overlapping aspects as well. This is not new to veteran listeners. Continuing. Of that last, frankly, I don't know what Peter Dale Scott calls this surprising claim. It sure is, because it's a lie. This surprising claim was at odds with the views of many U.S. intelligence operatives. It also contradicted the official position of the British government, which told its parliament in 2001, quote, Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda have been based in Afghanistan since 1996, but have a network of operations throughout the world. The network includes training camps, warehouses, communication facilities, and commercial operations able to raise significant sums of money to support its activity. That activity includes substantial exploitation of the illegal drug trade from Afghanistan. Meanwhile, there were allegations that the Brooklyn Al-Qaeda Center, as well as bin Laden, was involved in drug trafficking. Back in 1993, the New York Times reported that, according to investigators, quote, some of the 11 men charged in the Day of Terror plot to bomb New York City targets are also suspected of trafficking in drugs, unquote. Mujahid Abdul Qadir Manepta, M-E-N-E-P-T-A, a Muslim suspect in both the 9/11 case and the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing, was linked by telephone numbers on his cell phones to ongoing criminal investigations involving, quote, organized crime, drugs, and money laundering, unquote. And Raib Hijazi, H-I-J-A-Z-I, an Al-Qaeda terrorist arrested in Jordan in 1999, had previously become an FBI informant in order to avoid drug charges. The commission may have covered up and lied about this activity to protect CIA interests in Uzbekistan. It is certain that in the 1980s, the CIA, along with Pakistani and Saudi intelligence, hoped to foment Islamic fundamentalism in Uzbekistan. The CIA even, quote, commissioned an Uzbek exile living in Germany to produce translations of the Quran in the Uzbek language, unquote, for distribution by Islamist factions there. Hence, it is not surprising that, quote, from the beginning, the IMU has received substantial support from Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Agency. However, sympathetic foundations and banks in Saudi Arabia and the Arab world also remain major IMU sponsors. This would not be the first time that the CIA protected a drug traffic that supported the activities of its assets abroad. Boy, is that an understatement. Peter Dale Scott, by the way, has written about that at great length. This would not be the first time that the CIA protected a drug traffic that supported the activities of its assets abroad. We have spoken about this in many programs, many For the Record shows. The Anti-Fascist Archives series, numbers 24, 25, 26, 27, and 28 deal exclusively with various aspects of the CIA's and military's drug traffic to support or actually engender covert operations. Continuing. If Al-Qaeda supported its operations through drugs, it would have followed in the tradition of the drug money laundering Australian Nugenham Bank in the 1970s, founded in part by American veterans of the Vietnam War, with former CIA Director William Colby serving as legal counsel. Nguyen Hand had become involved in supplying arms to the UNIPOL faction of rebels in Angola that was later supported by the Safari Club. And the next section of Peter Dale Scott's book was the U.S. protection of the Al-Qaeda Center intended to help export and finance Al-Qaedists. There is also no treatment in the 9/11 report, and almost none elsewhere, of the allegations from Stephen Emerson that by 1987, the Al-Qaeda Center at the Al-Farouk Mosque in Brooklyn, quote, had become a center for counterfeiting tens of thousands of dollars. Similarly, there had been no government follow-up on the allegation of Youssef Babansky, citing FBI informant Imad Salem, that one of the Al-Qaeda cell leaders, Sadiq Ibrahim Sadiq Ali, quote, had offered to sell $1 million of counterfeit currency for $150,000, well below market value. Quantities of counterfeit $100 bills were later found at the apartment of Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman, unquote. J. M. Berger goes further, reporting from court testimony, quote, in order to support Al-Qaeda's operations, unquote, Mustafa Shalabi, S-H-A-L-A-B-I, the head of the Al-Qaeda Center until his murder in 1991, quote, employed a number of for-profit criminal enterprises, including gun running, arson for hire, and a counterfeiting ring set up in the basement of the Jihad office, unquote. Yet the 9/11 Commission report is silent about those serious charges, which U.S. prosecutors at the time did not pursue. Why this official reticence? The answer may lie in the fact that by 1996, bin Laden was, quote, supporting Islamists in Lebanon, Bosnia, Kashmir, Tajikistan, and Chechnya, unquote. And in step with bin Laden, the Al-Qaeda Center was also supporting Al-Qaeda's terrorism after 1992, quote, in Afghanistan, Bosnia, the Philippines, Egypt, Algeria, Kashmir, Palestine, and elsewhere, unquote. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda were not acting on their own. They were supporting projects, especially in Bosnia, Tajikistan, and then Chechnya, where their principal ally, Ibn al-Khattab, or Tamir Saleh Abdullah al-Suwalim, also enjoyed high-level support in Saudi Arabia. Khattab enjoyed a certain amount of logistical and financial support from Saudi Arabia. Saudi sheikhs declared the Chechen resistance a legitimate jihad, and private Saudi donors sent money to Khattab and his Chechen colleagues. As late as 1996, Mujahideen wounded in Chechnya were sent to Saudi Arabia for medical treatment, a practice paid for by charities and tolerated by the Saudi state, unquote. Ex-FBI agent Ali Soufan adds that America also supported this jihad. By 1996, quote, the United States had been on the side of Muslims in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and Chechnya, unquote. By protecting the Al-Qaeda Center and its associates, including Mohammed, and not prosecuting them for their crimes, including murder, the U.S. government was, in effect, imitating Saudi Arabia and Egypt by keeping open a channel to export those in America who wished to wage Al-Qaeda's terrorism, thereby ensuring that they would wage it in other countries, not here. After the arrest of Sheikh Rahman in 1993, Al-Qaeda closed itself down. But we shall see that an allied institution, Sphinx Trading, continued to be protected after 9/11, even after the FBI knew that it had helped one of the alleged 9/11 hijackers. Was all this protection intended to keep just such a channel open? It was certainly an intentional result of the protection and support from the Maktab, Al-Kidamat in Saudi Arabia. And one of the many organizations that the Bin Laden family was involved with was the World Assembly of Muslim Youth. And we have dealt in the past with the Al-Qaeda milieu in the Philippines run by Jamal Khalifa, Osama Bin Laden's brother-in-law. They in turn were networking with, among others, Terry Nichols, known as the Farmer. That is discussed in For the Record 456, and we came back to it briefly in For the Record 1176 as well. And talking about the World Assembly of Muslim Youth that was headed by Osama bin Laden's nephew, Abdullah bin Laden, one of the Saudi nationals who were flown out of the U.S. in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, whereas they could have been and should have been detained for prosecution. But instead, they got flown out. And, the rest, as they say, is history. P.B.L. Scott goes on to say, in Pakistan, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, or WAMY, quote, shared office space with the Benevolence International Corporation, an Al-Qaeda charitable fund founded by Osama bin Laden's brother-in-law, Mohammed Jamal Khalifa. A decade later, quote, in 2002, a raid by Bosnian authorities on the Sarajevo offices of the Benevolence International Foundation, a multi-million dollar charity, led to the discovery of a document called the Golden Chain, a list of Al-Qaeda sponsors. According to Craig Unger, quote, the donors of the Golden Chain were not just wealthy Saudis, they were the creme de la creme of the great Saudi industrial and mercantile elite, unquote. The list included Osama's brothers who ran the bin Laden group and Khalid bin Mahfouz, quote, the banker of the royal family and the most powerful banker in Saudi Arabia, unquote. In the 1980s, Khalid bin Mahfouz had bought up to 30% of the stock of the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, or BCCI, the bank co-founded by Kamal Adam, the former Saudi intelligence chief and Safari Club financier. We have spoken about the BCCI so many times, including and especially in our discussions with Lucy Commissar and also with John Loftus. Again, the BCCI discussed at great length in other programs. And we're going to talk briefly by way of conclusion about not only Saudi protection of, again, this overlapping cast of characters in these overlapping terrorist incidents, which in turn have been obscured not only to, or the investigations attenuated, not only not to get to avoid entangling Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries, but also to disrupt these ongoing covert operations in Afghanistan, Bosnia, and elsewhere. By the way, in Bosnia, Osama bin Laden actually visited with the first president of the, quote, independent, unquote, Bosnia after the breakup of Yugoslavia. That was Mr. Izetbegovic. Mr. Izetbegovic had been a member of the Young Muslims as a young man, and he was hoping to recruit for the 13th Waffen-SS Division, or Hanjar Division. One of the elite units in the newly independent Bosnia was named after and patterned after the 13th Waffen-SS, or Hanjar Division. And as discussed in the first of our programs, noting Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was the uncle of Ramzi Youssef, the mastermind of the first World Trade Center bombing, and again involved with the milieu in the assassination of Meir Kahane, the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, and the Landmarks case, and the 1998 Nairobi embassy bombings in Kenya, and last, but certainly not least, the milieu of the September 11th attacks, which got us in to Afghanistan, and again, the complicated cast of characters that I am talking about here, the complicated mosaic of covert operations. It is this, and by the way, one of the things that drives me crazy, frankly, we have spoken about so much of this before in other programs, albeit over many, many years, but this is how we got into Afghanistan. And reviewing, in Triple Cross, Peter Lance, who does not mention Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of the 9/11 attacks. In Triple Cross, Peter Lance, who does not mention Khalid Sheikh Mohammed's escape from Qatar, focuses instead on the way that later in the same year, U.S. federal prosecutors kept his name out of the trial of Ramzi Youssef in connection with the 1993 World Trade Center bombing. Assistant U.S. Attorneys Mike Garcia and Dietrich Snell presented a riveting, evidence-driven case and characterized the material retrieved from Ramzi's Toshiba laptop as, quote, the most devastating evidence of all, unquote. While Youssef's Toshiba laptop contained the full details of the plot later executed on 9/11, not a word of that scenario was mentioned during trial. Most surprising, during the entire summer-long trial, the name of the fourth Bojinka conspirator, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was mentioned by name only once in reference to a letter found in Youssef's apartment. And still later, something that I mentioned in our first program, and something that and it's something of a bookend to our tragic involvement in Afghanistan. The important inquiry into the infrastructure of Ali Mohammed's connection was quickly shut down by the FBI. The police officer testified in 2002 that the FBI had shut down the New Jersey police investigation of these connections without explanation. And still later, just how subordinated official policy could become to deep state needs was demonstrated in November of 2001 when Vice President Dick Cheney, at the request of Pakistani President Musharraf and the ISI, approved secret airlifts to ferry surrounded Pakistani and high-level Al-Qaeda fighters out of Afghanistan to safety in Pakistan. Quote, Cheney took charge. The approval was not shared with anyone at state, including Colin Powell, until well after the event. Clearly, the ISI was running its own war against the Americans. And again, we have spoken about so much of this in one form or another in so many different programs for many years. And it is among the reasons why people should get a hold of the flash drive. There is a tremendous amount of information dealing with just exactly this. We've been reading from the American Deep State, Wall Street Big Oil, and the Attack on U.S. Democracy, our discussions with Lucy Commissar, with John Loftus, with Daniel Hopsicker, and so many other programs deal with this, including many of the Al-Qaeda Muslim Brotherhood and former Yugoslavian connections going all the way back to World War II and the Grand Mufti. Indeed, it was the Bank Al-Pakwa's Youssef Nava, as a young Abwehr intelligence officer, who helped the Grand Mufti escape from France to the Middle East. This, however, concludes this program. This concludes For the Record program number 1182, Terror, the Afghanistan War, and the American Deep State, Part 2. This is being recorded on April 20th of the year 2021, I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.